Good morning. My name is Maria, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the What Deep Budget Cuts Mean for Economic Growth conference call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question-and-answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you. Ms. Smith, you may begin your conference.
Thank you, operator. Good morning. Just a reminder that this conference call is being recorded and that by being on the line, you consent to being recorded as well. We are joined today by Scott Lilly, CAP Senior Fellow, and John Irons, Research and Policy Director at the Economic Policy Institute, because as Congress considers cuts to its short and long-term funding bills, there's growing concern regarding the direct and indirect effects on the economy. CAP and EPI have organized this call to discuss the real economic price of deep budget cuts and threats of potential shutdowns. Scott Lilly is a former appropriations staff member who has been through a shutdown in the past and can offer some perspective from that experience. And John is going to talk about the macroeconomic effects of draconian spending cuts that are under consideration in several versions of short and long-term spending bills. And with that, I will turn the microphone over to Scott Lilly.
Thank you, and appreciate your dialing in to talk with us today. I think we had a very interesting turn of events on Friday when the House Appropriations Committee filed a short-term CR. Despite all of the saber-rattling that was going on a week, 10 days earlier, when they filed the CR Friday evening, it had very little in the way of truly problematic cuts. Most of what they took out were cuts that had been agreed to previously, elimination of earmarks that both sides had already agreed to. And so you have supposedly $4 billion below the operating level, but most of that doesn't come out of the true operating level. And the vast majority of the government will continue at the same level that it was prior under the current continuing resolution, the one that was passed in December. So it's I think it's politically interesting to sort of speculate what caused this change of course in the last week, and also it's interesting to speculate as to whether or not the leadership, which has always wanted to be more moderate on this than the rank and file, and particularly their freshman members, whether that leadership is going to be able to sell this package once it's more clearly understood what's in it. It still leaves us with the bigger picture of when do we get a deal and how does it come together and how much of what portion of these cuts is actually going to be factored into the appropriations for the remainder of the year for government programs, and I think that's still very much in question. But the fact that it looks like the Republican leadership blinked for this 2-week period, I think, leaves them in a somewhat weaker position in terms of insisting on draconian cuts in the next short-term CR. So that's where we are. John?
Yeah, well, thank you also for being on this call. Let me just make a quick point with a little bit broader perspective on jobs, the economy, and the potential impact of the spending debates that are happening now. First, just a reminder, everyone knows this, we still have an economic crisis going on. We have 9% unemployment. We have long-term unemployment that is remaining near historical high levels. And we just still have a very fragile economy as a whole. So this is, I think, just very important context. This isn't some abstract government spending issue. This is actually about economic policy. So it's very important that we get this right. The second point is in the talk about government shutdown or short-term continuing resolution, et cetera, it's, again, important to remember that at the very least, this is not good for job creation. If there is a government shutdown, or if there is $4 billion worth of cuts in the next 2 weeks, or if there's $100 billion in cuts over the next year, any of these scenarios means a drag on economic growth and a drag on job creation. And so, again, given the context of where we are with the economy, this is not moving in the right direction. Third, a full year reduction in spending on the order of $100 billion or $60 billion, as seems to be the more recent numbers, these all create significant impacts on job growth, on economic growth, and on job creation. Estimates from Goldman Sachs, estimates that we have done here at EPI, and others have shown that this is not just a minor speed bump, that this is a major roadblock to continuing economic growth and to continuing job creation. Finally, I think it has to be mentioned also that when we talk about the spending cuts, we also need to be thinking about the impact on federal investments, the ways we invest for future economic growth. Be that investments in education or innovation or energy policy or even just basic research. All these will have long-term impacts on the economy, not just this year, not just next year, but will have impacts for years to come. So I think at this point, given all the evidence out there on the potential job drag of these cuts, I think the burden of proof for job creation lies with those who are proposing these cuts. I think it needs to be explained exactly how does defunding schools create jobs? Exactly how does defunding community health centers create jobs? How does cutting scientific research create jobs? We're moving from a more abstract policy debate about spending to very specific spending cuts. And so these really do need to be seen and analyzed in light of a weak economy. And the question does need to be asked, exactly how will these create jobs? Because the economics of the spending cuts really does point to a drag on the economy and to a drag on job creation.
Thanks so much. And with this, we're going to open up the line for questions. Wanted to also add that economist from CAP, Heather Boucher, is joining us in the studio. It's also available for questions. Operator, please open up the line.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you wish to ask a question at this time, please press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster. Our first question comes from the line of Charlie Erickson from Hispanic Link News Services. Please state your question.
Yes, can you give us any specifics as to how this impacts communities, specifically the Hispanic community and the African-American community?
Well, I would say there's a wide variety of things. One of the problems with this proposal, and I'm talking not about the short-term CR, but the long-term CR that was passed over a week ago, one of the problems is that there are over 500 program cuts, and no one, including the people that drafted this legislation, fully understand what it's going to do, even though the House has debated it and passed it. It's still a bucket full of surprises. But I would say for any community that has a significant number of low-income households, there are some really horrific things here. One would be what they're doing to community hospitals, which happen to be the medical care of last resort for a great many Americans. There's a $1 billion cut there. Another would be what is happening to Head Start, a little over a $1 billion cut, which would be about 1/8 of the annual budget of Head Start, a little more than that actually. And that's being compressed into a six-month period, so it's really rather than a 12.5% or 13% cut, it's a 26% cut in the number of kids that can attend Head Start programs. I think the WIC cuts are really not only cruel, but they're wasteful because we've had data for years that show that whatever we spend on WIC ends up in larger savings to the government in terms of the Medicaid payments that have to be made for childbirth and postnatal care. So, we take the whole program if I went through all of the things that are going to affect those communities, the Title I cuts, on and on. But it's going to have a really huge effect on those portions of the population that have depended on government assistance for helping people get out of the lower ranks of our income and economy.
And let me make a more macro. I agree with exactly what Scott said, that there are huge impacts on different communities from these cuts. At a more macro level, we know that Hispanic unemployment rate is much higher than the national average. We know that the African American unemployment is much higher than national average. And so, for a lot of communities, these groups are extra sensitive to the state of the overall economy. And so, when you are neglecting job creation, you are disproportionately hurting the people who are, in too many cases, the first to be fired and the last to be hired. And so, by neglecting job creation, you are, in many ways, disproportionately hurting these communities.
If I could just add one thing to that.
Can you give us your name, please, and title?
Oh, I'm sorry. The last speaker, this is John Irons, the research director at the Economic Policy Institute, and I'll let Heather introduce herself.
And I'm Heather Boucher, senior economist here at the Center for American Progress. I just want to add one quick thing to what John said, which is one of the problems right now in the labor market is that folks simply aren't getting jobs. We're not seeing job creation. You've got a lot of people lined up in the unemployment queue, and as John pointed out, those are disproportionately people of color. The extent to which this budget does not lead to job creation will mean that those folks who are in the queue simply won't be getting jobs, and so that will have a disproportionate impact on those communities.
Do you think the Department of Labor is doing an effective job in working toward increasing the number of jobs available, especially the Hispanics, obviously?
That's not something that the Department of Labor on its own can accomplish, and that is a critical reason why this budget is so important. If this process leads to economic growth in our economy overall slowing, that's going to mean fewer and fewer jobs created, and it's going to mean that those who are already in the unemployment queue are going to have a much harder time finding jobs on top of the already historically difficult levels of folks finding new work. So this is not something that agency alone can solve, but this is a part of the entire budget process. At this point, it's a macroeconomic problem, and the budget is a big piece of that.
There are at least three major programs at the Department of Labor that are really hammered by this budget. The biggest is the Work Incentive Act, and that's money that goes to state and local governments to set up job training programs and job participation programs. It's a very big incentive for employers to try to find work for lower income people who come up and can be trained through these programs. Also, the Job Corps, which has been one of the most successful programs for training young unemployed people, and the Older Workers Act, and all of them have had huge cuts in this, and I think it makes the ability of the Labor Department to be proactive in any way about the kind of economy we're in almost impossible.
Operator, could you open the line for more questions?
Again, ladies and gentlemen, in order to ask a question, please press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. I'm showing no questions at this time, ma'am.
We'll stand by just for one more moment. Now, I know, and I've read briefly this morning that there is some agreement on a short-term CR. What kind of effects do short-term CRs have directly on funding for programs, even if the funding's kept at the same level for the previous year?
Well, you have a lot of things that happen under a short-term CR, and you basically have to constrain your level of spending. Agencies typically try to delay travel, and while most people think, they don't need to be traveling, if you're in the Mine Inspection Service or the Occupational Safety and Health Service, or or you're a meat inspector or whatever. Travel makes a difference between whether you are actually getting out to see what you need to be inspecting, or whether you're sitting in an office filling out forms. So I think you have a big slowdown just by the fact that you're on it continuing. Fortunately, this short-term CR that has been proposed by the Republicans is much less draconian than many had expected, and does provide the basis for some kind of an agreement to keep us going through March 18th.
Operator, it looks like we have another question.
Our next question comes from the line of Mary Ellen Flannery of the National Education Association. Please state your question.
Hi. I had a question sort of on the macro level about Head Start and Title I cuts. Is there any reason to believe that those cuts have long-term, larger implications for the economy?
Let me jump in. This is John Irons again with EPI. I think the short answer is yes. The long answer is that a lot of these programs, you know, Head Start, et cetera, do two things. One is obviously they give kids a head start. And so what that means from an economic and budgetary perspective is that you might achieve some short-term government spending savings if you were to cut these programs, but you're really hurting both the long-term economic growth as you have kids who are less well-prepared to succeed in life, and you also end up hurting the budget because they will have their economic outcomes when they are older won't be as good. And so that both hurts the overall economy and also hurts the federal government's bottom line. So this really is a case of cutting badly needed investments in a traditional economic sense where you are spending money now to be more productive and to save money in the future. So in many ways, this is, I think, one of the clearest examples of a very short-sighted policy by enacting cuts of the order that we've talked about.
Well, and one thing to add to what John said, which I certainly agree 100% with, is that to some extent, these programs also make it possible for parents to stay in the labor force. So you're doing sort of two things. You're not only making that investment in children, but you're making it harder for that parent to find safe, enriching, affordable, high-quality care that's educational for their kids while they're at work. So you're adding to that family's difficulties at a time when they can probably least afford it.
And I would say on top of that that both Head Start and Title I create a disproportionate number of jobs for dollars spent because there are a lot of people who are not high wage earners who probably don't have a lot of choices in the labor force and who can get jobs as aides in both Head Start and Title I. And so you create an awful lot of jobs for not a lot of money spent.
Operator, please remind people how they can dial in for a question.
Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you wish to ask a question, please press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad.
Looks like we have another question.
Our next question comes from the line of Patrick O'Connor of Wall Street Journal. Please state your question.
Thanks for doing the call. I was just curious. It looks like with this two-week stopgap measure we're going to see this week in the House that apparently, I don't know if Senate Democrats have signed off on it or not, but at least it looks like there are some palatable cuts in here. How much more room is there among some of the things that Obama listed in his budget, the programs that he wanted to zero out, or some of the program reductions for both sides to keep doing this? So is there enough room for them to do a couple more of these at 2 weeks and $4 billion, or did they, for the most part, exhaust some of the easiest things to cut with this initial batch?
Patrick, that's a good question. I wish I had a more precise answer for you. But my instinct is, having not kind of gone the side-by-side that you would need to do it, is that we've used this uses up a huge portion of the common ground of decisions that really these are spending cuts that both sides have agreed to previously. And so you sort of wonder what John Boehner's next play is going to be on March 18th and how he can placate his caucus and at the same time come up with something that's agreeable. So I'd say we got a two-week reprieve, but we still have a real prospect of a budget crisis by the middle of March.
And if I could add to that, this is John Irons again. When you look at, you know, Obama's overall budget, There were a number of reductions and terminations to programs, but there are also some increases on the investment side. Transportation infrastructure, for example, is one area where he invests. And so if you simply go through the budget and take the cuts and don't do any increases in the investment, then you're going to get, again, another drag on the economy. So, you know, maybe we can get through a week and do something that people have agreed to. But this is clearly not a long-term strategy, and we will have to confront cuts that will actually have a real impact. And you're doing that in the context of not having the investments that you need. So I think it's important to have a more comprehensive view of this. And the short-term CRs just don't get you, I think, the it's not the right process for coming up with an intelligent budget at the end of the day.
I would also say that there are a number of cuts that Obama has proposed in his budget that would be problematic to a lot of Republicans and even some Tea Party types. His cut on LIHEAP or low-income fuel assistance, his cut is deeper in 2012 than what the Republicans proposed for the current year.
Yeah.
And I've gotten several reports and seen several press stories where Republicans have already gotten a lot of flack back in their districts for even agreeing to the levels that they're at. So, you know, I'm not sure that there's as much common ground between the Obama cuts and the Republican cuts as you might expect there would be.
Thank you.
Operator, are there any further questions?
I'm showing no questions at this time.
We'll wait just one more moment and see if anyone else has a question.
I think there's one point that John touched on earlier that needs to be explored more, and that is the number of truly false cuts, not cuts that are going to reduce programs that Democrats believe have a long-term return to the economy, and I think that's important. But there are also a lot of cuts that are in infrastructure programs that the government's going to have to spend money on these things eventually anyway. Operation and maintenance at the Park Service, for instance, we have a $8 billion backlog in Park Service funding, and they're taking money out of what's necessary to fix that backlog. That doesn't mean that the infrastructure needs at the Park Service go away. It just means we're putting them off. And we're putting them off so we, instead of funding them now when we have a labor force issue that we need to put people back to work, we're putting that spending off into the future. Same thing's true as a very big cut, the total elimination of all repair improvement of courthouses in this country. And a lot of them are old and need to be replaced. The maintenance on them is much higher than it would be on newer. The energy costs are higher. So I think you go through this budget, you find a huge number of examples like that. I can't think of a more stupid way to save money than cutting the IRS tax enforcement force, which they have a very large cut there, and it will cost, based on studies that have been done for the Treasury Department, 5 or 6 times as much in lost revenues as is saved by the reduction of the salaries in the IRS. So I think this proposal needs to be viewed in terms of the false savings that are in it, as well as the negative impact it has on jobs and revenues that come from those jobs.
Operator, would you please remind people how to ask questions?
Again, ladies and gentlemen, in order to ask a question, please press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad.
I'm not showing any other questions at this time. If you do have any follow-up questions for Mr. Irons, Mr. Lilly, or Ms. Boucher, please feel free to email me at msmith@americanprogress.org. And just a reminder, this call was recorded. That recording will be available to media shortly as well. To get a copy of that recording, email me at msmith@americanprogress.org. Thank you for your participation today.
This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.